Hello, my name is Leila Ilaraza, and I'm a student project manager and supervisor at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues here at Dickinson College. Today I'm joined by Judith Grizel, professor of psychology at Bucknell University, and author of the best-selling book, Never Enough, The Neuroscience and Experience of Addiction. Dr. Grizel is visiting Dickinson College to deliver a Clark Forum program tonight, titled Never Enough, What Neuroscience of Addiction Can Teach Us About Living Our Best Lives. And she is joining me for an interview this afternoon. Welcome, Dr. Grizel.
Hi, Leila.
In your book, you mention wanting to become a neuroscientist to understand and even cure your addiction. There is this guiding idea, the I am my brain, that neuroscientists tend to focus on. However, you bring up that in recent years, quote, it's beginning to seem that the brain is more like a stage for our life to be acted out upon than like the director behind the curtain calling the shots, end quote. Can you unpack this for our listeners? And what is the brain's role in studying addiction?
Wow, that's a wonderful question. I would say that I was very naive when I began my career in neuroscience, believing, like many people did, that the brain was the source of all of our cognitive and emotional and behavioral events. I certainly think that the brain, and know brain activity is correlated with all those things today, but I see the source as much broader than just the brain. For example, our early interactions with our caregivers, our diets, we're now calling our gut microbiome, our psychobiome, our social interactions in classes or at work, all kinds of things are not only impinging the brain, but kind of pulling strings in the brain so that it can produce our experiences, including our feelings and our behaviors and our thoughts. I guess I, at the time, I figured if I could understand the molecules or the genes, I would understand the person, but I don't think that today.
And going off of that, there are many pathways to addiction, and you mention in your book that addicts tend to see alcohol as less of a problem than a solution to problems. The reasons you list as pathways include an inherited biological disposition, copious drug exposure, and a catalyzing environment. Can you explain these pathways and how they interact in a person to make someone more predisposed to addiction?
Sure. That question, you know, what are the neural antecedents of a substance use disorder has occupied me for the last 35 years in the basement of the biology buildings in the universities I've been at. I'd say that the answer is complicated, kind of like what is the brain? You know, it's much we don't know as much as we thought we knew about that. There are all those factors you mentioned. I would say the most penetrant, though, that I didn't realize so clearly when I was writing the book, because the literature is always evolving, is early exposure. Because young people learn everything better than old people, they learn it quicker and easier, and addiction is a form of learning where the drug goes from kind of a fun thing to maybe a tool to now, you know, necessary in someone who's a regular user. In that process, that's the brain adapting to the drug exposure, and because it adapts so well when you're young to everything, including drugs, I'd say that is the primary source in the population of suffering. In fact, some studies say that 90% of people who have a substance use disorder begin using before they're 18. Yeah, the role of development is critical.
And this kind of goes into the plasticity of the brain and how it can modify itself and its functions in response to environmental stimuli. How does the brain's ability to change impact from one's first use of a drug compared to, say, an advanced addiction?
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the fundamental traits or conditions of the brain, it's sort of like a law of neuroscience, I would say, is that the brain needs homeostasis. It is the most persnickety, organ. It's also, you know, the most complex organ for sure. It's, you know, there's a lot we still don't know, but it's very delicate, which is why, you know, you hear about people who have brain injuries and then they don't really bounce back. It's not like breaking a bone. Neurons, the brain cells are just particular. So one of the things that the brain requires is stability. So for instance, if you stick your hand in hot water or ice water, you'll, you know, be cold or hot, but you can't do that with your brain. It has to really be in this very tight window of temperature or you're unconscious and dead. It's just generally true. And the brain protects or even defends and maintains that stability by kind of counteracting exposure to addictive drugs. So any drug that works by altering brain activity, the brain tries to counteract. It's just the, it's necessary for its value to us as a, you know, an organ of helping us survive. And so when it counteracts it, it creates the opposite state. So if you're using a drug like alcohol, let's say, to feel relaxed and have fun, the more you take it, the more tense and irritable you get, you know, really in the long term. So if the drug reduces pain, then the brain counteracts that by producing suffering so that you'll kind of come out even with the drug on board. So in every case, unfortunately, the brain is creating the very condition or state you're trying to avoid with your regular use. And there's no way to really prevent that because it's such a fundamental capacity of how the brain works.
Very interesting, that paradox there. Going into specific substances and how they affect our bodies and brains in different ways, in your book you call alcohol a pharmacological sledgehammer, cocaine a laser, and marijuana a bucket of red paint. Could you explain a bit what you mean by these descriptions?
Yeah, it's funny. I think the value of metaphors is that there's really no way to capture what exactly you're trying to say, but hopefully this evokes the meaning. So alcohol is a sledgehammer because it acts so globally and so bluntly to disrupt neural functioning. It slows down all activity, but it does that in so many different ways. And for that reason, really, it's one of the most toxic drugs to the brain. For instance, you could take opioids for 50 years and you wouldn't really hurt your brain in the same way, but alcohol, we know, is really damaging to brain cells. Cocaine, I said, was a laser because it's almost the antithesis of alcohol in this way. It acts very precisely, just doing one thing and doing it really well, which is to block the reuptake of dopamine and norepinephrine. Two things, I guess. And then I said cannabis or marijuana is a bucket of red paint, which is true in that red paint kind of makes everything stand out and bright. So like alcohol, cannabis acts all over the brain, but unlike alcohol, its actions are pretty specific. So it's more like a laser that's doing something everywhere. And what it's doing everywhere is enhancing the neural communication or kind of reverberating across synapses, which are the gaps between cells, to kind of highlight or underline import. And for this reason, you know, everything seems like glazed in red, which, yeah, I guess I could say it that way.
Our drive to alter experience you talk about as being universal, but that also extends beyond just humans and is practiced by some insects and other primates. How do other species have chemical-induced experiences?
Yeah, it's kind of an astounding thing. You know, one of the arguments people have tried to stop addiction is, you know, just don't use. But really not picking up mind-altering substances is unnatural. It's like saying, just don't eat, just don't have sex. I mean, it's kind of a drive in human beings that's like eating and sex also in other animals. So we tend, you know, we are animals. Now, there's so many stories, you know, cats like catnip, probably people know that. Birds will sometimes purposely consume fermented berries. Other animals consume fermented fruit. elephants are known to break down distillery doors when they can and consume the actual alcohol at the distillery and get loaded, sort of purposely. But yeah, there's some fun stories and insects too. And my favorite one, which is just amazing to me, is a species of ant in South America. I forget the name exactly right now, but they live in big ant mounds. And in the mound, they maintain and care for and nurture, in a way, a population of beetles. And these beetles, for a while, people didn't know, you know, why are the ants spending so much of their resources, like, you know, farming beetles? Well, it turns out that on the back of the beetles' legs, on the little hairy back of their legs, they grow a fungus that every once in a while the ants harvest and then all together consume the fungus, and then they get very slow for a few days. And as far as people can tell, there's no nutritional benefit to this. It's just that, you know, the ants are having a little holiday with the beetle fungus. So it just seems to be, I guess it goes back to the nervous system. The central nervous system is designed to adapt, as we talked about, but it's also really designed to experience. And we like the edges of experience, otherwise it's not much of an experience.
Do you think that studying these other species could potentially lead to advancement in researching the human condition?
I think answering any question with scientific methods can lead to all kinds of benefits, including, you know, insights you would never predict. So yes, I think trying to tackle something as problematic and widespread as addiction, we need all the avenues we can find. Some of those might be based in, you know, understanding communities or developmental neuroscience or genetics or insects, for sure.
Going into the understanding communities, those who are more prone to addiction, you mentioned, might have skills or tolerances that can actually benefit different facets of society and research. Can you explain how certain pathways or tolerances can be used to the benefit of a person? And have you found this to be true in your own experience?
Yes, so I will say that the very traits that made me such a kind of terrible drug addict are some of the same traits that make me a very good scientist and citizen, really. So I really appreciate novelty and exploration and discovery. As we were just speaking, I was looking for a way to change my experience, and that translates pretty directly into being a scientist, because I'm tinkering with whatever I'm tinkering with, you know, molecules or mice or data to try to understand things. I was also very persistent and had a high tolerance for punishment. And that's also pretty handy, especially if you're going to grad school. Even in undergrad, I think you can appreciate that, you know, you have to kind of be tough around the edges. You can't be too delicate. So there's that. So I'm persistent. I'm really curious. I kind of driven to a fault in a way. If I'm engaged, I'm really engaged. And that's the problem with people who are regular drug users, because they forget about their children's birthdays or their jobs or the rent bill. But it's also useful because, you know, dabbling is probably not going to solve some of the big problems that we have in society. So I think I'd even go so far as to say, I don't think I'm unusual in this, but I think that there's a lot of capital in people who are currently hiding out, consuming substances or gambling or pornography or social media, even just sitting on their phones all day, where they have maybe, they're kind of masking or covering up their real proclivities. You know, I was forced to in treatment, and if I, you know, went through this whole thing so I could not, you know, realized I could not use and live. So, you know, it's not like it's a walk in the park necessarily, but I think one of the benefits of that is that I really was forced to find other ways to explore and press myself. And I think those ways are helpful for scientists, but also maybe for entrepreneurs or artists, for example.
In a similar vein, you claim that punishment is not an effective deterrent when it comes to excessive drug use. What alternative ideas or solutions are there to help encourage recovery? And what steps should we take as both a country and communities to support ending addiction?
Ending it's going to be tough. I guess now that I'm older, I wouldn't say that. But let's say we want to reduce the burden of addiction and divert the tendencies that lead to early death and all this suffering into better ways. I think the point about punishment is really pretty global. So if you take general psychology, for instance, you'll probably learn that punishment is almost never effective. Reinforcement is so much better at helping people shape behavior. Our brains are tuned for praise or treats, and they're, you know, probably for good reason, a little insensitive to punishment. It makes life better, I think, to get along this way. So punishment doesn't work hardly at all, and reinforcement does. So one of the newer strategies is called contingency management. And it's very interesting because it's kind of against our folklore about what we think we should do with people who are messing up our streets and stuff. Instead of punishing, we give rewards or prizes to people for staying clean or having a certain amount of time or showing back up to the court. And it goes against many people's natural tendencies, as I said, but it turns out that another way that addicts, substance use disordered people, are kind of built is to be really kind of oriented toward reward, which is part of the problem, right? Like, it really does a lot for me that I might be able to score and get high and have this, and it's worth so much. So we can kind of exploit that by giving treats, and obviously not drugs in this case, but money or Target gift cards or good coffee coupons or even just praise. I think those sorts of things have an outsized impact on people. And one of the tricks about it is that you can start small, but you have to get bigger. So you kind of reverse engineer addiction in that way. And that is effective with every drug that it's been looked at so far. So it's not, you know, a magic bullet, but I think it'll be much more effective than trying to punish people or, you know, reduce the supply, which looks to be impossible.
On a more personal level, how has reorienting your brain towards reward, how have you done that to help maintain sobriety post-rehabilitation?
So it was really critical for me, I think, first to have some time to consider and kind of get away from the triggers and the people that were part of my disordered use, but also to have something to look forward to. And I was very fortunate in that I was able to go back to college. I was able to go to grad school, which, you know, was a pretty good substitute because, you know, you have to be a certain type of compulsive to be successful in those places. But I was able to get into science. I was able to travel. Today, so scientific discovery was a good kind of substitute for me, but also the challenges of living. Now that I'm older, I realize, you know, there's so much richness in relationships, in exploration, kind of internal exploration, but also external. It doesn't have to be in a scientific laboratory. It could be on a trip to a new country. I love live music, and I was just thinking on my way down here that I take a lot of my spare time and money to travel with my husband to go listen to live music, which is, you know, a pretty good antidote to despair. And it's not unlike drugs in that it's exciting and unknown, and yeah, you're moving So anyway, that's one idea. But I think there's so many ways, and it depends on what people like. I think getting a telescope and looking at the night sky, or making any kind of art or any creative endeavor at all. Relationships are probably the most challenging thing we do. And, you know, it's notable that people who are deep into a substance use disorder have few relationships. And building relationships back up is something that I think is critical to recovery.
According to the National Institute of Health, this study was done pre-COVID in 2019. College campuses have seen an increase in cannabis, alcohol, and illicit drug use. The average college student does not have a fully developed brain while they're being exposed to social and academic pressures throughout the year. Recognizing you have an addiction when surrounded by others consuming substances can be challenging. Why do you think there's been such an increase in addiction on college campuses? And is there a way to treat or mitigate the impacts of addiction in the future?
Maybe everybody says this when they're old, but I feel like it is such a hard time to grow up. I think it genuinely is a lot harder. Things are much harsher. You know, I used drugs, but they weren't like the drugs that are around now. And so two things, I guess, if I were gonna like make it succinct. We have more potent ways to evade or escape reality than ever. And they're in our pockets, you know? I mean, they're social media, pornography. You know, pornography is like having fentanyl in your pocket if you're a 14-year-old boy, you know? It's so potent and damaging in the same way, really, in lots of the same ways. It doesn't stop your breathing, but anyway, so there's all this access, and there's so much angst or despair. So I would say that, you know, our biology hasn't changed in the last 50 years very much, but our experience and our environment really have. And I think that we used to think that people were using substances because they were in despair. They were anxious and depressed, and that has really risen. And so then they're seeking out drugs. But now we understand that these two are like partners in a dark dance. You're in despair, you seek drugs, the drugs make you more despairing. They're going to reduce your sensitivity to beauty and pleasure and social relationships and anything but the drugs. So I think that these are escalating at such steep pace because of lots of factors, not the kids or the adolescents' faults, but because their brains are so plastic, they have all these substances or tools available, and they're understandably anxious and sad, I think, many of them. We know many of them. It's kind of like a perfect storm. So what is the antidote to that? I think that I really think the adults are dropping the ball. And I think that, you know, we call children children because they're not responsible. They can't be responsible for themselves. So there's that. But from the looks of things, the adults are not doing much. So I would say I'm going back to rely on the kids. The kids are they have so much potential and capacity. So I would say that they should honor their cravings and look for ways to really honor them by feeding them something that will not hurt them, not make them less sensitive to pleasure, but will make them more sensitive. So I don't know what that is exactly, but I think it should be challenging and risky because that's kind of what they're designed for. I also think that the rest of the world needs to do what we can to support young people in finding paths that are not so self-destructive. My recent path in that is to have an initiative of advancing scientific literacy, but I'm not advancing mine or even other scientists so much as I'm working with groups of students, high school, college, and grad students, to translate scientific research for social media. And just kind of skipping over the middlemen parents and politicians, let's say, and having kids teach other kids what's going on, and I'm looking for volunteers.
Where can people find your work and keep up to date with your research?
Well, you can find my work on my website at Bucknell, which is being redone a little bit to account for this new initiative on scientific literacy, so amplifying young people's voices and knowledge. So you can look for me at Bucknell. It's j.grisel, G-R-I-S-E-L, at bucknell.edu. And I'm also very soon, in the next few weeks, hopefully, going to have a website called truedrugs.org. And True Drugs is going to house and archive the social media posts. And there will be a place there to get involved, either by supporting these initiatives, or if you're a student, maybe volunteering to help. And the students there will be working in groups with other students and with me to get the word out.
And this concludes our interview on behalf of the Clark Forum. Thank you again for sitting down and having this conversation with me.
Thank you, Layla.